Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America is leaving a gilded age. Decades when the rich got rich fast and everybody else lagged behind. Now there are losses all over, and in the Obama White House, a push to reapportion the pie. This hour on Point, we'll look at who's taking the biggest hit in the current meltdown and what the country may look like in the rebuild. Top, middle, and bottom. You can join the conversation. Who do you see taking the hit so far? Can we change the way the economic pie is sliced and still grow the pie? Joining me now in the studio is Lawrence Katz, professor of economics at Harvard University and former chief economist at the U.S. Department of Labor. Larry Katz, great to have you with us.
I'm delighted to be here, Tom.
And in the studio, Claudia Golden, also professor of economics at Harvard and director of the National Bureau of Economic Research's Development of the American Economy program. She is co-author with Larry of The Race Between Education and Technology. Claudia Golden, great to have you as well.
Glad to be here.
Larry, look out at who's taking the hit so far in this economy, top, middle, and bottom. Where is the weight of this really falling? We know it's all over. Is it equal? Is it more heavily felt in one sector than another?
Well, this downturn is incredibly broad-based, and it's really hitting everybody. It's certainly dramatic at the top end, where you've seen huge declines in the stock market values and even declines in bonuses. But certainly the pain is much greater when you look at those in the middle and the bottom, because you have to put this in perspective. Over the last, the boom period of the 2000s, 2000, 2006, almost all the growth of income went to the very top. So they had a lot more cushion for losing out. Middle-class families basically saw no real income gains in the 2000s, and poorer families saw very little change. The employment losses are just amazing in this downturn.
Mm-hmm.
College graduates' unemployment rate has, doubled, but, the increases are even greater among working-class families, among less educated workers. In particular, the housing sector was incredibly important for propping up incomes and employment for less educated people.
Construction work, all that?
Construction, more non-college men were working in construction in 2006 than in manufacturing by a substantial number.
Wow.
So the housing was the only reason one saw a lot of families doing reasonably well in the early 2000s, and that's just devastated. So, and that particularly affects places like California, Florida, in addition to the manufacturing downturn in the Midwest. So you see three types of pains. People's portfolios have seen huge declines.
If they have them, right?
If they have them, those thinking
stock about
retiring.
Mm-hmm.
Second, those who still have jobs are on shorter hours, mm-hmm. and their wages are basically frozen. Even at places like Harvard, we're all facing
mm-hmm.
wage freezes
mm-hmm.
now.
Mm-hmm.
And third, the most devastating is loss of jobs. We have seen more job loss in the last 14 months than any time since the Great Depression. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, because the extended unemployment rate, counting people who not just counted as unemployed but are so discouraged they're not working
mm-hmm.
anymore or on short-time work, unable to get their normal workload, is now 15%, 14.8% of the workforce. That's just an amazing number. One out of every six or seven Americans are struggling just to gain employment.
And, of course, these big new numbers on Friday, unemployment over 8% now. Claudia Golden, you're our economic historian. How do you see this downturn, meltdown, crash, call it what you will, comparing to other down cycles we've seen in American economic history?
That's a very, very good question. It's very important. Many people believe that if they can find a period in the past that looks similar, then it's not going to be that bad, because after all, we survived,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of like saying, I have a heart palpitation. When did I last have this palpitation?
Did I survive last time?
Yeah,
did I come back and thrive?
Yeah, I survived, so that's
right.
Very, very good. Well, there have been many periods in U.S. history that have looked similar. We've been through many recessions, the mid-70s, the early 80s, less so in the early 90s. Some have had features similar to this one. This one has had three major features having to do with the banking financial sector
mm-hmm.
And having to do with the stock market and having to do with the real economy. Most of these periods have had rapidly rising unemployment, for example, just like this one, but most of them lack the financial and the banking aspects, although we have been through periods like the S&L crisis in the 80s that has had serious banking problems.
But not the same kind of across-the-board lack of confidence
in the
banking.
That's right. And this is where this notion of the perfect storm comes in. And yes, the Great Depression did involve all three. It involved a banking crisis, a stock market downturn, which we then called a crash, a general malaise, which we then called collapse of the real economy. But certain things were very different. The banking crisis was different. In the 30s, it was a collapse of depositor confidence and a failure, terrible failure on the part of the Federal Reserve System for not reflating the economy. And yes, the important thing is, yes, the heart palpitation was something that we got, you know, over. By 1941, we were back on track. We were at the same level of real GNP per capita that would have been the case had there been no Great Depression.
Of course, the story we're all told is that it took a great war, a world war, to do that.
Well, not exactly. In fact, the chairperson of the Council of Economic Advisors would say that we were getting out before that. Thank goodness you don't need a war to get out of a Great Depression. Okay, she is.
I mean, we've got two at the moment, but they're a little different.
Yeah. And but a tremendous amount was lost in the interim, an enormous amount. You don't lose a third of GNP and not lose a lot. But let me say just two things. Mm. We were back on track, but inequality after the Great Depression was much reduced and stayed that way for about three decades. But in addition, this is where the sort of similarity ends with where we are today. We really have to set down the fact that the good news is that things are really different now. We have social safety nets that didn't exist then. We have Social Security, unemployment insurance, food stamps. Mm. We have the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, so that we shouldn't have this crisis of confidence that brought down so many banks in the 30s by runs on banks. People are phenomenally richer than they were then, 4 to 5 times richer on a per capita basis. We're a lot healthier than we were. We don't have the extreme poverty of the elderly. We don't have a rural America that looks like a horribly developing nation. We have improved technology, and we have a considerably more educated population. So we're starting from a very different basis.
But, Larry, does that mean we're better set really fundamentally to weather this and come out on the other side? I mean, we came out of the Great Depression into the American century, into the sort of golden era of American economic growth. Here we are reading over the weekend the New York Times interpreting these unemployment numbers on Friday as, what do they call it, a fundamental restructuring of the American economy underway, sort of suggesting that we may come out of this in an economy like we haven't seen before, not necessarily a better one.
Well, I think that one should, you know, I'm sort of pessimistic in the very short run. Mm-hmm. Things are set in place, so the economy really is going to do worse in the next several months. But I'm potentially optimistic in the long run.
Good.
That basically, we are not going to need a decade of depression and a world war to restructure the economy. The parallels are quite striking, as Claudia said. For example, the last time the income share of the very top 1% got up to 18%, which it reached in 2006, was eerily 1929. Mm-hmm. So the sort of crash now and the decline there. But the key thing to remember is there are a set of things that go on that could lead to a much more widespread prosperity like we had 47 to 1973. The first is the stock market crash by itself and the reduction in the attractiveness of things like finance. You know, Claudia and I have been working on sort of what do people from our top colleges do with their lives. In 1970, it's sort of the widely shared prosperity era before the recent era of inequality came in. Only about 3 to 5% of Harvard graduates went into finance. By 1990, it was 15%. By 2006, it was 40%.
Maybe we could use them in a better way. Not only them, but right across the country.
So one huge advantage is reducing, you know, you tripled your income by going to finance if you were a Harvard graduate in 2006. Now the incentives will be more to move into things like science, teaching, medicine. So that will be a way of both having a more egalitarian and more innovative economy.
I want to look at more of what may change the direction of the economy. But let me ask you this. You're one of the economists we're going to speak to in this hour. Was the inequality, the tremendous run-up in inequality that we saw up until very, very recently, Was it to blame for this crash? Is it somehow part of what set us up for a meltdown?
Well, I think it partly is. I mean, there are two components of the inequality. One component, which was very important in the 1980s and 90s, really was, you know, someone like, you know, innovating like a, you know, Microsoft or a Google, mm-hmm. you know, new technologies, people being rewarded, you know, a superstar like Michael Jordan. No one really begrudges. They are producing a lot of things that benefit society.
Well, Michael Jordan, a lot of entertainment, Google maybe, or Microsoft over time, a lot of innovation that brought wealth to this country.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, much of it in the 2000s appears to have been reallocating risk in ways that don't seem to, you know, you could have said in 2006, mm-hmm. look at our finance sector, look at the innovation in providing mortgages to so many people, in finding new ways of getting money to entrepreneurs, but that doesn't seem to have been the case. A lot of it really does seem to have been just ways of reallocating risk in ways of skimming money from others. And when you have literally 70% of the income growth in the economy from 2000 to 2006 went to the top 1%.
70%?
70%. That is not a healthy economy. And by the 2000s, the median family was no longer gaining from economic growth. We clearly were not going to have. That was setting up for the downfall we've seen today. That wasn't so much true in the 1990s boom, where you had much more widely shared prosperity.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about how the economic downturn is hitting the rich, the middle class, and the poor, and how the crisis may reshape who gets what in America, in the American economy. I've been joined by Claudia Golden and Lawrence Katz, both professors of economics at Harvard University, co-authors of The Race Between Education and Technology. We'll talk about education, a very important factor here. We'll be joined in just a moment by Larry Bartels at Princeton. But let's get some calls here first. Linda in Iowa City. Hi, Linda. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi,
Tom.
Hi.
I guess it seems to me that we do have a way of a model for getting out of this, and that's what happened, at least to some extent, in the 90s under the Clinton administration. Slightly higher taxes on the wealthy, and programs that help the working poor, the poor, and the middle class, that help them get the education, the training that they needed, in part financed by higher taxes on the wealthy.
Of course, the long-term trend, and it turns out, didn't change. Does that worry you, Linda, or do you think sort of a Clinton formula is enough?
It was undone by the Bush administration. He took the budget, the projected surpluses, and turned them into tax cuts for the wealthy. They stopped any kind of regulation, and they didn't enforce the ones that we had.
Linda, we will look at it. The model of the 90s. Let me hold that for a moment and go to Chuck in Lumberton, North Carolina. Chuck, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, guys. I feel like the whole approach has been approached wrong. I feel like that we have to do it like the military, and we have to do it like anything else that we do. It's just like a house. We try to put new shingles on houses that's being defective, and mm-hmm. we try to do different things to homes and things mm-hmm. that is so far damaged that it does not do any good. I think what you have to do is tear it all the way down to the foundation and then build it back up. It's like a military guy who goes in the military, and you have to tear them all the way down before you build them back up and build it back up right.
That sounds painful, Chuck. What tear down to the foundation, what do you mean by that?
I mean, like the automotive industry, for an example, we've been wanting them for years and years to build better cars, energy-efficient cars, to build just better vehicles. But instead, what did we do? We turned the wrong way and started building gas guzzlers and things as if gas wasn't going to eventually run out, or our dependency to depend on it so much
right.
that we lean on other countries, when we should have done the right thing from the beginning. So since that we didn't do the right things in the beginning, we suffer from that. And that should be an example right there of turning all the way down, building it back up, and do it the right way. I think after everything is said and done, that this country would be a better country in the long run if we tear it down to the foundation and build it back up.
Chuck, I think a lot of people will hear that, sort of let it burn to the solid foundation and back up. On the other hand, a lot of pain in that. We'll look at that as well. Let me get one more. Jim in Lincoln, Nebraska. You're on the air, Jim.
The problem is, and I thank you for having me on, the problem is one of reframing the question. Right now, we have too large a sector of the economy involved in manipulating money to improve professional and institutional wealth. And I saw a statistic the other day that nationally it's almost 23% of the entire economy is tied up in real estate, finance, and insurance alone. So if you take out the government share of it, better than half of the economy is tied up and not doing anything that's productive. And we have demonstrated, because of all the wealth we have, which is incredible, even poor people have TV sets and microwaves and washing machines for the most part. So the wealth is produced by improving the productivity of individuals. And we can do this with improved machinery, automation, software, direct connections between consumers without having to go through clerks and the like. All this has been proved in the marketplace over and over again.
Jim, if we do that, will we come out of this with a more equal sharing of wealth, or does that matter to you?
It doesn't. Well, it's not an equal sharing of wealth. It's having a massive amount of wealth so everybody lives a good life, even at the poorest levels. And that's where it is. But you can't do this if the professions, the engineers, the managers, the corporate presidents and investors are constantly trying to capture wealth within their industries, which have been obsolete in some cases for 50 or 100 years, just maintained so by professional status quoism.
Jim, you're great. Let us dive in on all that. And Larry Bartels joins us now from Princeton, New Jersey. He's director of the Center for the Study of Democratic Politics at the Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School, professor of politics at Princeton, author of Unequal Democracy, The Political Economy of the New Gilded Age. Larry Bartels, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom.
So we're looking at inequality. Larry Katz and Claudia Golden have sort of laid down a baseline view of it. You hear our callers' concerns. Linda saying maybe the 90s were the model for how to get out of this and grow again. Chuck in North Carolina saying we've got to tear this economy down to its foundation. And Jim in Lincoln, Nebraska saying, you know, let's get more efficient and put it in not just in professions like insurance and finance. How do you look on what's going on now? Do you see real change in the way we approach the economy coming out of this crash?
I think there will be some, yes. I think the sense of crisis and the needs that people perceive to deal with the crisis overlap in important ways with the political agenda that President Obama has wanted to pursue even before the crisis reached its current depths. He was talking by the very beginning of his campaign about trying to rebuild the incomes of middle-class families, which have stagnated so dramatically over the past 30 years or so. And so I think he'll be looking for ways to do that within the context of responding to the more short-term dramatic elements of the crisis.
I asked earlier, and let me ask you as well, Larry Bartels, whether income inequality itself, pretty radical inequality by American historical standards, was part of the problem that got us into this meltdown and mess. Americans are very tolerant of different levels of wealth and income and in many ways celebrate that. But did we somehow go too far in this last cycle?
I would say it's a symptom of a set of problems that have contributed to our current difficulties. Kevin Phillips has a nice historical analysis comparing previous historical incidents of great inequality, the Gilded Age in the late 19th century and the Roaring Twenties and the current period of inequality, and pointed to lots of striking similarities between them, not only similarities with respect to economic developments, but with respect to political developments. All of those periods were periods in which there's been a great relaxing of economic regulation and a surge in the apparent political influence of the wealthiest citizens. If you go back to the label of the Gilded Age, it was based on a novel by Mark Twain, which was really a novel about political corruption and the way that opportunities for quick riches seduced people into using the government in ways that didn't contribute to the public good.
Claudia Golden, but the story has also been, since the Ronald Reagan era, that this unleashing of the top created an engine that would pull the whole economy. And we did have pretty strong growth for a long time in these last 30 years. Do we need to do it that way, or did that way prove itself, what, ineffective because the middle and bottom didn't come along for the ride fully?
Well, it's not very good when the middle and the bottom don't come along for the ride. We have to ask why that's the case. Going back to what Larry said, which I think was very interesting, after this ambiguous period called the Gilded Age, this, quote, relaxing regulation and this great political corruption.
Do you mean decades ago or the one we've just come through?
I'm sorry. I'm talking of the one that Larry was talking about when he was referring to Kevin Phillips, the real Gilded Age.
The old original.
That's right. We had just the opposite. Maybe we can look to that. And, I mean, after all, Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, was the great regulator. He was the person who said, we're going to bust the trusts. Mm-hmm. And that we then went into
malefactors of great wealth.
Exactly. We went into a completely different period of the beginnings of regulation, and cries for and calls for the end of corruption, both at the federal level and, of course, municipal city level.
Mm. So, Larry Bartels, do you see a different politics already having emerged here? Does that change the shape of the economy? When you look at, I mean, what's happened so far with the distribution of wealth in this country in this crunch, and what do you expect coming out with the kind of 10-year budget that Barack Obama recently laid out?
Well, I think it's too soon to say how far-reaching the changes will turn out to be. From the point of view of ordinary citizens, they're really only now beginning to realize the depths of the crisis and the difficulty of the policies that will be necessary to deal with it. But I think there's potential for a major political shift of the kind that Claudia described.
Larry Katz, what do you see coming here? What's in the numbers that Barack Obama has laid out and the numbers in Congress now? Does it foretell a real shift in American policy and income distribution as the Reagan agenda did?
Well, I think it could foretell. I think, as Larry Bartels just said, it's too early to say for sure. But I think there really are two different visions of strategies. The Reagan strategy was really one that we would label as trickle down. It was cut taxes for those on the top. They will do entrepreneurial things, and that will spread out benefits to the rest of the economy. And for small parts of the last 30 years, that has happened, particularly the late 1990s. Mm-hmm. But in truth, there has been much slower growth for the typical American family with that strategy than in the sort of first 30 years after World War II. The other one we might call percolate up, tries to have a much broader base, give access, broader access to education, which really slowed down over the last few decades, create some direct, you know, employment opportunities through things like investing now in green technologies. And you know, having a more broader base prosperity, changing the incentives by having somewhat higher taxes at the top end for certain things, you know, but allowing people to, you know, thinking about, you know, not getting great returns from doing wrong things with energy by thinking about cap and trade. So I think there are potentially major restructuring that could send talented people into things, you know, like science and new green technologies and being teachers in K through 12 schools rather than all running off to be consultants and investment bankers. And that potentially could both be a more productive society and a much more egalitarian one, but we're a long way from getting there.
Claudia, of course, Ronald Reagan came into office against the backdrop of the 70s when there had been some pretty tough economic times, even though Reaganism hadn't taken over yet. I mean, what did the 70s tell us, or those earlier decades tell us? What went wrong ultimately with the more egalitarian approach to the economy?
Well, I don't know if anything went wrong with the more egalitarian approach to the economy.
Well, we ended up with stagflation, with a market that was in the dumps. People were pretty unhappy with the economy by the 1970s.
Yeah, but I don't know whether it's certainly in the 70s we were still in what we would say would be the shared equality, shared growth. And what happened was something that we're still debating, which by the middle of the 1970s, it was clear now that we were in something called the productivity slowdown. So it wasn't that the economy was revving up and producing the way it had before.
Right.
And it slowed down. And it then picked up later, but it slowed down for quite some time.
Let's get a call from Nashville, Tennessee, and Betsy. Hi, Betsy. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
A lot of things that I was thinking of have been being discussed already, but I just wanted to talk a little bit about the fact of the income inequality and the fact that we've kind of, middle class and lower middle class working people,
mm-hmm.
seen ourselves sort of put in this corner of, well, you have to save for your own retirement, and we're not going to do that collectively for you, which that's, whatever way it is, that's, you know, okay, but if you have to invest in the stock market to mm-hmm. save for retirement, and then we see so much fraud and abuse,
mm-hmm.
we totally lose trust and faith in our leadership. I just want to say I think it kind of seems like we're going in a very down spiral here. I personally got lucky and kept a lot of money out of the stock market because of some experiences I had where I was seeing leadership making very short-sighted decisions and not looking out for what long-term is in the best interest of our overall society. I'm kind of holding back and going, you know, I think I'm not going to trust you anymore. And I wonder if your guest could speak to that kind of mental thing that's going on with everyone.
Absolutely. Betsy, let us pick that up. Because Larry Bartels, that's right in your wheelhouse. I mean, Betsy's really talking about the political economy and what she describes as a loss of trust among people who really thought it hasn't been working for them. Do you see that changing? And what difference does it make to the economy, its growth, its success, if it changes or doesn't change, if you have that confidence or you don't?
I think the distrust is of long standing, but the focus of the distrust has changed over time. One of the great challenges for progressive politicians over the last generation has been to overcome people's distrust of government and convince them that government programs could make their lives better without hindering or handicapping economic growth. Now, as she suggested, the distrust has been kind of shifted toward economic leaders rather than political leaders, and toward the notion of an opportunity society that has been a kind of centerpiece of conservative ideology in recent decades.
But you hear Betsy in Nashville saying her distrust has extended to political leaders, that she's not sure that they're that they've been in her corner as middle or lower middle class American lately. Does that end up rippling through and hurting the whole economy when a citizen feels that way? Or is it, oh, well, it doesn't really matter, just let the economy roll?
Well, it'll be interesting to see. I think it is a political challenge. If President Obama wants to adopt policies that will make a dent in our current economic problems, he's going to have to generate political support from ordinary citizens and from members of Congress. And insofar as they're convinced that government isn't on their side, that's going to be much more difficult.
Claudia Golden, what do you think? A kind of citizen movement to see the way the pie is apportioned changed here? Or have Americans just gotten used to the Reagan model and will revert to that once the crisis passes, if it passes?
Well, I think that people want change. They want to trust. I think that we saw that in this wonderful campaign, the turnout in November.
Mm-hmm.
I think people understand that this is a real problem, that there's going to be pain, and it's going to be somewhat shared pain. And they see that it is shared pain, that this is, in some sense, oddly enough, an egalitarian recession affecting lots of people. I don't want to say that the bottom isn't affected more, but everyone's being affected.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about how the economic downturn is hitting the rich, the middle class, and the poor, and how the crisis may reshape who gets what. We've been joined by Larry Bartels from Princeton University, author of Unequal Democracy. And with me in the studio today, Harvard economics professors Claudia Golden and Lawrence Katz, co-authors of The Race Between Education and Technology. Let's get a call from Jim in Canton, New York. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm 75, and I look back over my years in the economy active. We were based, the middle class, on what I'd call, I guess, a value-added economy. I mean, I worked for Corning. We were making glass out of sand. That's tremendous value added.
Yeah.
And Henry Ford recognized that his best customers were his own employees. And we've gone off of the manufacturing base, and I think that was the heart of the middle class. I don't know how you get that back, but I'll take the comments off air.
Thanks, Jim. Larry Katz, how about it?
That certainly is true that a big part of the strong middle class economy, particularly after World War II, was a strong manufacturing sector, broad-based jobs both for sort of managers who are more educated and clerical workers as well as for, you know, blue-collar workers. But the decline in manufacturing has actually been going on, you know, as a fairly long-term trend with a couple components there. Some of it is just technological advance that we can produce a ton of stuff with fewer employees. Some of this is international outsourcing and the rearranging of the international economy.
But here's Jim, after all these years, having watched that, like you and I, saying, you know what? I've watched this. I've heard about the service economy and technology coming in. And after all these years, I don't believe we can support a middle class without that kind of value-added economy that he saw in manufacturing.
I think that there are many, many different ways of having value-added. You know, a healthcare system that's providing people with good care, new ideas, you know, and a wide range of things. And there are other things that don't look like traditional manufacturing, from using the, you know, internet in new ways to producing a wide range of other human. I mean, the point is, we would, if we had a society where we could produce all the manufacturing goods we needed with a very small share of the workforce, there's still a lot of other things to be done. We need a healthy manufacturing sector. But one thing to keep in mind is that manufacturing today has now become actually a fairly educated sector.
Mm-hmm.
There are not a lot of jobs, and there will not be, given the International Division of Labor, for non-college educated workers. So education is going to be a key to a middle class, even for keeping a manufacturing sector together, as well as for the broader areas. And part of the devastating aspect of the last decade or 20 years has been the combination of new technology and outsourcing has really affected the middle of jobs. It's been sort of complementary to people at the very upper end. It's sort of been not that related, you know, to people doing in-person services. You can't outsource that. A computer doesn't know how to what's garbage, you know, for a person to pick up, how to make a bed in a hotel, but they can do a lot of things in manufacturing. I think the technology is there to stay, but there are a lot of ways with new education to allow people to harness, to take advantage of it in ways that don't look like traditional manufacturing jobs.
Larry Bartels, does the middle class need political protection somehow, or even trade protection, to get back into a position of growth to be healthy again, or not?
I think they're going to need policy help of some kind. It's helpful here, I think, to think about three different kinds of cycles or dynamics that interact with each other. One is the pretty consistent difference in policy priorities between Democrats and Republicans. And if we look back through the whole period, the last half century, we see really marked differences in the extent to which middle class and poor people have prospered under Democratic and Republican policies. But then laid on top of that cyclical dynamic, there's also the long-term changes with respect to technology and global competition that Larry Katz has talked about. And that's made it increasingly difficult to design policies in which the middle class prospers. So, for example, it is true that the middle class and working poor people did noticeably better under Bill Clinton than they had under Reagan and Bush or under the second George Bush. But the differences were less marked in that period than they were in the earlier part of the post-war period. So that's the second dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
Then the third dynamic is this very occasional historical crises that we've been talking about. And if we're in one of those now, it'll provide a political opening for the Democratic Party, since they're in power as this is playing out, to invent policies that will succeed in addressing the long-run difficulties of the middle class.
Let's get a call from Barry in Boston. Hi, Barry. You're on the air.
Hi, Don. How are you?
Very well. What do you see, Barry?
Well, I wanted to make a comment about a few different points that were made.
Okay.
First and foremost, is this issue of manufacturing in this country, and I'd really very much appreciate a response from your guests who are there.
Let's hear it.
But insofar as manufacturing is concerned, there's a very, very well-known Nobel laureate, Milton Friedman, who talked about this issue, and I think he had a perfect explanation, which I still think rings true as much today as it did 20 or 30 years ago. And the culprit, okay, which nobody seems to talk about, is the minimum wage laws that the Democrats continually push, okay? It's the minimum wage laws which cut out the bottom line manufacturing and force it to be done overseas.
You mean you think Americans would be better off if they could make less than the current minimum wage?
Absolutely.
What? But isn't that sort of counter? I mean, if I could make $5 an hour, I'd be better off than if I make $8 an hour?
Excuse me. Riches are not mandated by the government generating minimum wage laws, okay? What you do when you have a minimum wage law is you prevent the manufacturing of those goods in this country, and you destroy all those bottom-line jobs that could be here, okay?
Still, a buck a day is a buck a day, no matter what the economics, right? It's hard to get by on if that's what you're making.
Maybe it is hard to get by on it, okay, but those things, it's a...
But I take your Friedman point. What's your other, Barry? We'll come to it. What's your other?
Hello?
Yeah, Barry, but I take your point there on the view of Milton Friedman on that. You had a second point?
Well, I just wanted to comment that a large, portion of the problem that we have. One of the first ladies that called in was talking about how Bill Clinton had improved the economy and so on and so forth.
Yep.
And I just want to point out, as a number of people have commented, that it was Bill Clinton who was pushing Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae to grant loans to people, which basically I think was the catalyst, which caused a long cascade and basically is largely responsible for the tremendous problems that we have right now.
Helped make the subprime mess there. Let us pick both of those up, Barry. And Claudia Golden, let me come first to you.
Sure.
Here's an acolyte of Milton Friedman. He says the problem is a minimum wage. And that Bill Clinton and others pushed for loans to go where they shouldn't have gone. Therefore, a mess.
Well, I'm a student of Milton Friedman's. I went to the University of mm-hmm. Chicago. Mm-hmm. And I think Milton, with all due respect, and I think he's utterly brilliant, was talking about a high minimum wage economy. You have a minimum wage that's extremely high, and you may indeed do something like price out your manufacturing goods, but we're no longer in a high minimum wage economy. Let me say one thing about the previous conversation about how it might be that if we don't have a big, strong manufacturing sector, we won't be able to have a big, strong middle class. Actually, we can go back before manufacturing to when we were an agricultural economy mm-hmm. and people owned their own farms. And as manufacturing came in, the same questions were raised. How can we have a shared prosperity if we're not all farmers and all agriculturalists? Mm-hmm. In fact, it was initially manufacturing that raised the specter of great inequality.
Mm-hmm.
So we move from sector to sector with different problems. Maybe we sort of look back and romanticize what was once the past, when in fact the present, we can find shared prosperity there as well.
Larry Katz, on the issue of Bill Clinton and pushing housing and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and getting loans out there for everybody, or pushing that idea, that was an effort to spread the wealth in a way, to get everybody in on the housing
yes.
boom, which went bust, a misplaced effort?
Well, I think the initial idea and the initial policies of trying to create greater access to credit to a broader swathe of the American population were successful in the short run in actually increasing home ownership and giving people the ability to form businesses. But in the 2000s, it sort of, financial deregulation is always a bit difficult because innovation in the financial sector happens much more rapid than regulators can move. And when you then had a new administration that came in that really didn't believe in regulation at all, you had sort of the combination of rapid innovation, people buying off essentially the regulators or not looking the right way as we see in the Madoff type case, and that the initial benefits, you know, turned into loans being made to people who really couldn't pay them back, had no way of doing this, and it went much too far. We don't know the counterfactual of what would have happened if the Clinton administration, you know, had had a third term or a Gore administration with a different view on regulation have come in. It was a nice initial idea. It clearly didn't work out well. I just wanted to make one more point about the minimum wage. The U.S. minimum wage is at a very low level today relative to what it was 40 years ago. It's absolutely not relevant for the manufacturing sector. It matters for in-person service sectors like hotels and janitorial services where it gives some clout to workers and improves their wages. You could have a minimum wage high enough that affected manufacturing. The U.S. of the 21st century does not.
Larry Bartels, though, you hear in our caller Barry's observations this concern that for however well-intentioned, government intervention may lead to slowing the economy, gumming up growth or a rebuild from the trouble we're in now, and it's big trouble. What do you say to that, Larry?
Well, economists are generally big fans of efficiency, and one of the reasons that they tend not to like protectionist trade policies, for example, is that they believe that we're not going to do as well as a society in those conditions than if we have free trade with other countries. But they justify that argument on the grounds that the social gains can be redistributed to make everyone better off. And then the political challenge is to figure out some way for that actually to happen. The minimum wage is actually a good example. The real value of the minimum wage declined by about 40% over the last 40 or 50 years. At the same time that huge majorities of the American public all through that period have favored minimum wage increases. So if we had a political system that responded directly to the policy preferences of ordinary citizens, the minimum wage would probably be a good deal higher now than it is. But because of the complexity of our political system and the disparate influence of relatively affluent people in the system, we don't have that kind of policy.
Let's get a call from David in Concord, Vermont. David, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Say, the topic of your show suggests the following question. Maybe your guest can comment on it.
Okay.
Why isn't it that society has come to recognize extreme wealth as a social ill in the same class as extreme poverty? As we attempt to control poverty by putting in various floors, shouldn't we attempt also to limit extreme wealth, which, after all, money is power. Power combined with greed, which is a powerful human emotion, will seek to advantage itself. And it seems to me that this certainly is a viewpoint that should be considered.
David, thank you very much for the point. Larry Bartels, let me come back to you on that. I mean, that would have seemed kind of off the screen a few years ago. But given the mess the economy is in now, after this spike in the concentration of wealth, maybe it's not an unreasonable question. What do you say, Larry?
Well, our views about rich people change from time to time. There certainly, we went through a period in which there was a lot of enthusiasm for the virtue and energy of the rich. But we have had periods in American history where we've been much more suspicious. And indeed, democratic political systems through the ages have periodically been suspicious about the political influence of the wealthy. We mostly manage to ignore those concerns by telling ourselves a happy story about the distinction, the firewall that we've built between the economic system and the political system. So we like to think that we can have lots of economic inequality, but then when we turn to politics, our voices are all equally heard. In fact, though, that isn't the case. Economic power does translate into political power, and that greatly complicates the project of political reform.
Claudia Golden, whatever the politics, you've looked at education over time and seen that as the key to spreading the wealth, and spreading in a productive way that means growth for the whole economy. There was an enormous leap during and after the Great Depression in the percentage of Americans who had a high school education. What's the next leap, and is the country prepared to take it? It seems lately like we're just treading water at best on education.
Well, there are a couple of things that we've got to do. One is that we have to, in some sense, go back to high school and make it better, which may mean going back to more the elementary grades and making it better. And one of the reasons to do that is that we have to make certain that those who graduate from high school are really college ready, because the next leap is the final transformation, which is the transformation into higher education.
Universally nearly, or much
That's
more widely
right.
than now.
Exactly. To make it more mass, more universal, just as we did with high school, just as we did in the 19th century with elementary and common schools, is to bring everyone into it. And to do that, it isn't enough to provide funding, although funding is very important, is extremely important. Mm. But it also has to be that people should be college ready. We can't have our colleges do remedial courses. It's a waste of resources. So we have to make certain that kids that enter colleges really can do the things that they ought to be doing.
Larry Katz, we just got half a minute left here. How do you see us set up facing, I mean, we don't even know if we're at the bottom yet. Many signs say we may well not be. Do you see the country set up to turn out of this in a way where politics and economics combine for a lift?
Yes. Well, we're not yet at the bottom, but I'm very hopeful that sometime next year we'll start seeing a turnaround, and that if the president's budget passes, that we could have a society that both has broadly shared prosperity from bigger investments in education and infrastructure and from a somewhat higher tax rates at the top end and a stronger safety net. That's the hope, that we don't need both a Great Depression and a world war in order to rebuild the economy this time.
Well, that sounds great from where we're standing right now. Lawrence Katz and Claudia Golden, co-authors of The Race Between Education and Technology, thank you for being here. And Larry Bartels, author of Unequal Democracy, thank you as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.